fog is accompanied by a driving wind and intermittent downpours. So bad is the situation that by the time I reach the golf course near Langmore Manor, I'm actually pleased to see it. The weather ensures that even the most committed of the Argyle Brigade has stayed at home, and so the trudge across the green is a welcome respite. It doesn't last, however, and the path soon spits me back out onto the road once more. The long walk from there down to the front at Charmouth is a cold, wet, and insanely perilous one. It then gets slightly better for the next few miles in the run-up to Stonebarrow as I walk along a country lane, still nowhere near the sea. From there, I finally pick up the coast path proper again and head towards Golden Cap, which Rowley advises me is the highest point of the south coast of England. The fog is still thickening, and I can barely see my feet below me, let alone the cliff edge. The rain is constant, and the driving wind all the more intense now I'm back on the coast. The path itself is climbing and falling steeply, and in other circumstances I get the impression this may be an exhilarating section. Here and now, however, I'm struggling. My mood is dark following my dice with death along the busy roads earlier, and the conditions are now in the realms of the genuinely treacherous. Any notion of seeing the views that normally accompany a high peak on this trail are foolhardy as I clamber blindly onwards through fog and wind. By the time I make it to the tiny village of Seatown, I'm exhausted and soaked to the bone. I make an executive decision and head to the local pub for lunch. This proves to be the first decent move of the day. It would be hasty to claim I reach anything approaching dryness, but I certainly warm up a good deal in front of the fireplace in the tiny front room. I stay there, nursing a pint for over an hour, in the hope that the weather will ease. It doesn't, however, and with an eye on the time, I come to the realisation that I need to get back out there. I prolong the inevitable a little while longer by purchasing a second bag of pickled onion crisps. To the incredulous stares of the bar staff and clientele, I then put back on my soaking wet coat, sling the pack onto my back and brave the storm. What a guy. The afternoon's walk is more of the same as the rain and wind actually get worse. The fog loses a bit of its intensity somewhere around Thorncombe Beacon, although not enough to actually see anything of what Rowley advises are magnificent views. A long, relatively gentle descent follows in the run-up to Epe Mouth. Here I must negotiate slippery stepping stones to get over the water, before a steep climb back up the cliff again. The remaining few miles to West Bay stay along the cliff top, and as the fog continues to clear, I begin to get the first proper views of the day. The cliffs have again changed colour, from the chalky white of the last few days to a striking yellow sandstone. As I approach West Bay, I keep my eyes open for waymarkers for another trail, the Monarch's Way. I was unable to find anywhere to stay in West Bay, and so need to walk an extra few miles inland to the nearby town of Bridport, where I've booked a room above a pub. By the time I arrive in the small and attractive town centre, the rain has finally stopped, and the wind died down. My spirits are beginning to rise as I pass a number of appetising restaurants and swanky bistro pubs. I then spy mine. I stand looking at it from across the street. I double-check my reservation. I even Google it to make sure there aren't two pubs in Bridport with the same name. There aren't. Every window is covered by a St. George flag, and a skin-headed man in turned-up jeans and tightly laced Dr. Martens stands outside the front door smoking. Looking like a drowned rat, I reluctantly approach and enter into the bar. Heads turn in my direction, and there's a brief Western movie-style silence before the shaven-headed clientele return to their pints. I'm shown to my room by a woman, visibly weighed down with gold rings, earrings, and enough necklaces to put Mr. T to shame. The ensuite bathroom, which is three doors down along the hall, doesn't have a lock, so I'm advised to knock before entering. I do my best to get dried off, before leaving the pub with no intention of returning until I need to sleep. I spend the evening in a decent nearby pub and return to my room at about 11 at night. I return to find a full-scale party underway, complete with wall-to-wall sound system. My room is directly above and is literally shaking with the sound of the bass. I sit awake for the next 3 hours until the music finally stops. During that time, there are at least 2 proper fights outside my window and a couple of mere skirmishes. Now I'm conscious of sounding like a snob here. I hope I'm someone that endeavours not to judge a book by its cover in this life. However, do you know what I've learnt in the last 6 hours? That sometimes, dear reader, you can judge a book by its cover. Every now and then, a person or a place is exactly what it or they first appear to be. Unsurprisingly, I don't sleep a wink for the remainder of the night. Being a naturally optimistic chap, however, I do use the time wisely. Partly thinking about, somewhat ironically, given the current circumstances, how this trip has, fingers crossed, rid me of my insomnia. I had, as previously mentioned, already discovered the extraordinary benefits of walking long distances in that regard. Nevertheless, I was fully expecting a good many more restless nights on the trip. Hours spent conversing with my disobedient conscience, attempting to coax the blighter into sleep. As it stands, my conscience and I have, barring the odd spat, got on like a house on fire thus far. I've even grown rather fond of the old chap. Back on point, however, I also use the time to book accommodation for the next few nights via the app on my phone. In light of recent events, I take a good deal more interest in this than usual, reading countless reviews of each pub or hotel, instead of just finding the cheapest option. In addition to this, I listen to an entire Woodhouse audiobook. It simply isn't possible to remain glum when reading Woodhouse. Lastly, I sit looking out of the window, waiting for the first cracks of daylight. When they arrive, I leave the premises at lightning speed, posting my room and front door keys back through the letterbox as I march off toward the sea. The walk back to West Bay is one without particular merit, but I enjoy it immensely, as every step takes me closer to the ocean and further from Bridport. When I arrive, my first task is to climb the steep hillside to the top of the impressive East Cliffs. At the time of my arrival, the area is enjoying notoriety, thanks to the popular TV show Broadchurch, which uses the vast sandstone cliff as its backdrop. A short stretch of cliff-top walking follows, where I ignore the golf course to my left and gaze lovingly out to sea. It's a warm summer's day, and I feel the trials and tribulations of the previous 24 hours evaporate across the sparkling water. A pair of gulls appear from below the cliff edge and fly beside me at head height for a few hundred yards, as if welcoming me back onto the trail and ensuring I'm still in one piece. I descend into Burton Bradstock, where Rowley advises me I must walk inland along the river for a short while before climbing the next steep hill to the summit of Burton Cliff. A brief diversion due to coastal erosion follows, before another enjoyable spell along the cliff edge. I realise I'm repeating another senseless mantra as I stride onwards, another random snippet of internal monologue that has escaped from my subconscious and become stuck in my throat. Stephen Fry is a very nice guy. Stephen Fry is a very nice guy. I wonder how long I've been saying this out loud as I concentrate on breaking the maddening loop. After a while, the path drops down onto Cogden Beach, and the far-reaching views ahead of me convey that a long, flat stretch of walking will form the remainder of the day's hike to Abbotsbury. Along the way, there are a few long and cumbersome sections that involve traipsing across loose pebbles for miles on end. With boots and heavy backpack, this is increasingly unpleasant work. As I slowly and comically plod through endless mountains of the remorseless tiny rocks, I realise that I probably look very similar to a man that's just rubbed an entire tube of expired ibuprofen gel on his feet, or Mr. Soft from the Soft Mints adverts. After a while, I converse with Rowley to discover that Cogden Beach is part of the famous pebble ridge called Chesil Bank, which leads all the way to Weymouth. A wave of nausea washes over me as I contemplate the prospect of 2 full days walking on pebbles. So far, Dorset has given me 2 decent cliffs and a whole lot of misery. My anti-Dorset stance was thankfully premature, however, as the landscape changes shortly thereafter. I soon find myself walking along a track behind the beach for a few miles, where I resume my enjoyment of the hot and sunny day. The cloudless blue sky to my right is inhabited by noisy gulls and crows vying for airspace, whilst in the distance, to my left, I spy a hovering bird of prey across the patchwork fields. Stretching out in front of me are views of Portland Island, with its famous lighthouse silhouetted against the horizon. The landscape between here and Portland is visually striking as the flat green fields wind in and out against the strip of water that separates them from Chesil Bank, and then the mighty ocean beyond. The path then curves inland, away from the sea, as it heads for Abbotsbury. The first thing I notice is the arresting sight of the chapel of St. Catherine's, stood alone atop the hill in front of me. I climb up to it on my way into the village and have a good old nose around the ancient structure. It's far smaller than its prime vantage point on the hill that first makes it appear, but is nonetheless impressive for it. After soaking up the views for a few minutes, I wander down into Abbotsbury itself. The beautiful country village with its popular swanery and picture postcard high street is a welcome sight indeed. The pretty upmarket pub that I'm booked into for the night provides the perfect antidote to the previous night's lodgings. I spend a relaxing evening in the pub garden before retiring to my room for a long and peaceful night's sleep. Feeling refreshed and full to the brim with a sense of plucky thingamibobs, I leave early the next morning to begin the 13-mile trek to Weymouth. The path ambles its way through attractive farmland full of playful lambs and their sleep-deprived mothers dozing in the bright Dorset sunshine. I stroll contentedly down a few country lanes, passing the swanery and off into the English countryside. One or two steep climbs and drops ensue, followed by a stretch along a hillside ridge, all the while remaining a few miles inland. Sometime later, the path finally turns right and begins to head towards the sea. I walk steeply downhill for a good while, through flourishing arable fields and along the edge of areas of woodland. It may be because I'm too far inland to benefit from the sea breeze, but it feels like the hottest day of the whole walk so far. The walking is generally easygoing, but I'm covered in a clammy sweat as the factor 30 limply melts away. The path eventually winds its way down to the sea at Roddon Hive and then on to Langton Hive Point, where the views open up ahead of me. I'm now walking the distinctive stretch of path that I had in view towards the end of yesterday, with a strip of water separating me from the endless Chesil Bank to my right. The path clings onto the edge of the flat landscape up against the shoreline. I'm passing through a field of bright yellow oilseed rape when I'm viciously attacked by a swarm of roughly a gazillion insects. Tiny white flies that appear from amidst the crops and head straight for my face. I flap heroically, but there are too many of them. Go on without me, Rowley. Save yourself. I would cry if I were as nuts as a bag of nuts. This merciless assault in broad daylight goes on for a full 10 minutes until I reach the end of the field. I regain my composure, spit out the last of the little blighters that flew into my mouth and, dignity intact, go about my business. A little while later, I pass the Moonfleet Manor Hotel, named after J. Meade Faulkner's famous novel Moonfleet. They'd have to be pretty stupid smugglers to conduct their business in this neck of the woods, I think to myself as I pick a few deceased white flies from my ears. The flat open landscape doesn't seem very conducive to secret rendezvous and the stashing of contraband whatnots. A mile or so along the path, a military rifle range hones into view. I negotiate my way around it to the sound of gunfire. I seem to have passed as many rifle ranges as golf courses on this trip. As I'm contemplating which of these is the bigger nuisance to the walker, a large caravan site appears up ahead. The Holy Trinity of coastal fly-tipping is complete. The terrain through this section is surprisingly muddy, given the dry weather. I slip and slide my way around Lynch Cove and round another small fenced-off military zone before straightening out, adjacent once more to Chesil Bank. I soon reach Ferry Bridge and the road that leads to Portland Island. I'm booked into a hotel in Weymouth for 2 nights so that I can walk the entire route around the island tomorrow. For now, however, I pass by the road and begin the final few miles into Weymouth itself. This is a boring affair along pavements and through increasingly built-up areas. Eventually, I arrive at the harbour side and locate my hotel. It sits on the cusp of two very different-looking areas. On one side, an attractive harbour with rows of sailboats, pretty cottages and shipyards. On the other, a high street full of chain pubs and fast-food restaurants waiting for nightfall. Later that evening, I venture into the town to locate a laundrette. The trusty old garments need one final detox before the finish line. Whilst they spin themselves into something resembling decency, I grab a bite to eat and sit along the promenade watching the waves lapping against the shore. I stare at the views of the coastline stretching off into the distance and wonder how long now before I see a view of cliffs ahead that I won't be walking on. The following day's circular walk around Portland Island begins with the strange feeling of heading off without my backpack. The route starts off with a climb up through a residential area, past the vast and infamous prison. From there, I arrive at what I assume is intended to be some sort of zoo. It is hands down the most depressing zoo I've ever been to. Small groups of kangaroos, goats, and a few other assorted animals sit huddled together in featureless, enclosed square patches of grass. Everything about their body language screams boredom. A shabby-looking goat ambles up to the fence and half-heartedly investigates me before ambling back again, unimpressed. The trail then winds down to the coastline, and I'm pleasantly surprised to discover some decent walking. The route gets quite rocky in places, and I get a touch emotional, staring up at a kestrel hovering above. The same question as the previous evening creeps unwelcome into my mind. How many more times will I see this now? I watch the beautiful bird until it glides off across the clear blue sky. It's another scorching hot summer day, and the sea sparkles enticingly as I continue along the undulating track. I walk through a landslip area and a couple of disused quarries on the long trek towards Portland Bill. I climb back up to the main road at one point and take in some fantastic views before veering off back down towards sea level again. When I arrive at Portland Bill, the iconic red and white striped lighthouse with its attached visitor centre is bustling with tourists enjoying the sunshine. I walk past the crowded cafes and find a spot on the grass to sit and eat lunch. I ungraciously munch down the melted Mars bar as I stare up at the famous old landmark. I stay here a while, enjoying the views back out across Chesil Bank, before deciding to crack on. There are impressive views all along the route back towards Ferry Bridge. The walking itself, however, is a little less inspiring on this side of the island. Some pleasant hillside strolling eventually succumbs to the built-up residential areas of First Western and then Chiswell. I'm not complaining, though. It's been a much more enjoyable walk than I was expecting, if I'm honest. As I make my way through Chiswell, I pass several cars displaying the same bumper sticker, "Keep Portland Weird," which warms me to the place even more. I arrive back at Ferry Bridge a few hours earlier than I expected to, the lack of backpack giving me at least an extra half mile an hour. I decide, therefore, to take the stroll back into Weymouth rather than getting the bus. Perhaps the repetition of these few miles cancel out the missed half a mile in Plymouth. I get back to Weymouth at mid-afternoon, with the sun still shining brightly. I'm struck by how much more attractive the town looks in the daylight. I manage to locate a decent-looking pub and while away the rest of the afternoon in the beer garden, with views out to sea. Durdle Door, Indian Chip Butties, and the Selfish Armed Forces. Weymouth again looks a lot more attractive in the morning sunshine than it does in the neon glow of the night. I begin the day's 14-mile trek to Lulworth with a stroll along the promenade under a cloudy sky. I pass through Bowley's Cove with its large and striking, if slightly worse for wear, Art Deco hotel. The wind is picking up now, and from here on things start to become more strenuous. The path begins to rise and fall as it hugs the cliff edge. The Jurassic coast continues to reveal its grandiose beauty at the summit of each climb. The views begin to open up ahead as Weymouth fades away behind me. Early on, I meet a large group of ramblers travelling in the opposite direction on their way to Portland. We swap a few stories regards what immediately awaits us in either direction and comment on the somewhat alarming rate at which the cliff edge is visibly eroding along this stretch. Huge chunks of muddy earth being ripped away from the landscape and sliding into the watery abyss below. Great tears in the ground beneath our feet, which provide the most visually dramatic example of coastal erosion I have yet witnessed. I then lap up their praise like a needy child upon telling them how far I've come, and continue on my way filled with a gratifyingly inflated sense of self-importance. A feeling which sustains me over the next few miles, as the path levels out for a spell of easy cliff-top walking until I eventually roll into Osmington Mills, where I stop for lunch. The afternoon yields more of the Jurassic Coast's visual splendour and some of the most enjoyable and challenging walking of the last few days. The chalky white cliffs climbing and dropping with increased intensity as the strong winds continue to enrage the waves beneath me. By the time I've climbed the awesome White Nothe, I'm exhausted, but loving every minute of it. The views back to Portland behind me, across the raging sea, are stunning. The moody skies are full of lightning, quick gulls, criss-crossing amongst the clouds above me. The path winds down to the impressive Bat's Head, a jagged, triangular rock jutting out from amidst the crashing waves. Late in the day, I approach arguably the South Coast's most famous and popular landmark. The natural limestone arch that is Durdle Door attracts a plethora of tourists from far and wide, and as it comes into view, the path becomes increasingly more inhabited. In spite of walking through so many bustling tourist towns and villages in the last few weeks, it's still something of a shock to see such a wide demographic of punters adorning the path. Families with pushchairs, folks sporting trainers, smart shoes, and even the occasional high heel noticeably outnumber my fellow sturdy boot and thick-socked wanderers. Delighted dogs of every variety bound and splash around enthusiastically. I climb down the steep wooden steps onto the beach and sit amongst the crowds, taking in the beauty of nature's architecture. I spend 20 minutes or so watching the world go by. A small group of fishermen sit motionless on the shoreline. Couples pose with selfie sticks beneath the archway, and optimistic gulls tentatively tiptoe between picnicking families. I eventually heave on the pack and lumber onwards. The crowds continue to arrive as I traverse the well-defined pathway away from the beach and towards the village of Lulworth. I stop only briefly to observe the crowded Lulworth Cove before taking root in the nearest pub for a well-deserved pint of the local. My bed for the night is courtesy of a picturesque 16th-century inn that bills itself as extremely dog-friendly on the website. This is not an overstatement. The canine is lord and master within this friendly and welcoming establishment and outnumbers its human clientele at a rate that defies all logic. They freely wander the narrow, crooked hallways, which are adorned with doggy artworks. They lounge contentedly under every table and fill every square foot of fur-coated floor space. Later in the evening, I sit in the bar area surveying the dinner menu. A seemingly ownerless pooch sprawled out at my feet. I order the enticingly named Indian Chip Butty. How could I not? When it arrives, it's not a disappointment. A mountain of chips covered in curry atop a chunky slice of toasted bread. I feel certain there is a cheese element also, but I'm not able to visually confirm this amongst the culinary carnage. About halfway through, I begin to wonder if there is some sort of rosette awarded for successful completion of this dining event. I soldier through bravely and amble, bloated and fulfilled, over to the bar for a much-needed digestive. I get chatting to the friendly landlady for a while, and after impressing her wildly with stories of my trip so far, she drops something of a bombshell. So what are you going to do about getting through the rifle range tomorrow? It'll be closed until Saturday. After a further panicked exchange and some frantic internet searching, I establish that tomorrow's section of Coast Path, titled by Rowley as Lulworth Rifle Range, on reflection there may have been a clue in there somewhere, is closed on weekdays for military shooting practice. It's with some degree of quiet despair that I retire to my room for a short while later. I eventually fall asleep with the prospect whirling through my mind of missing out on a day of the trail, so close to the end. A prospect that becomes a reality as I awake to the smell of wet dog and the sounds of joyful wagging tails thumping excitedly along the corridor walls outside my room some 7 hours later. I plot an alternative route for the day whilst wolfing down, no pun intended, the trusted Weetabix. I take some solace in the fact that the route I map out is considerably longer than both the coastal route I would have walked today and Rowley's suggested alternative, so I will at least get a decent day's hiking in. I'll walk along the quiet country roads to the village of Wareham, where I'll pick up an interesting-sounding trail called the Purbeck Way. This will then lead me to Corfe, where I'll spend the night before heading back down to the coast the following morning to rejoin the path proper. I develop an increasingly embittered opinion of the armed forces and their insistence on blocking my path for the paltry purpose of national defence, as I dice with death for the entire morning along the distinctly unquiet roads between Lulworth and Wareham. The chipper and friendly locals are keen to let me know their opinions, regards my choice of walking route, via a multitude of colourful hand gestures from behind car windscreens as they swerve to avoid me. Eventually, mercifully, I arrive in Wareham. I locate the river where the trail begins and set off on what I trust will be a greatly improved afternoon. The sun beats down as I stroll along the flat riverside path and eventually out into farmland and sparse heathland. The going is easy and the views somewhat lacking. Perfectly pleasant, but a touch uninspiring. I spend much of the time considering this lack of inspiration. Has the coast path ruined other walking for me? Today's walk is a decent one, taking an abundance of wildlife and varied terrain. Yet I'm left cold, wishing I was beside the sea. What this walk doesn't do, you see, dear reader, is smack you round the face. It doesn't kick you to the floor and then scream into your earhole to pick yourself back up. It doesn't pin you to a cliff edge or make the hairs on the back of your neck stand on end. It doesn't switch in a second from peaceful serenity to dramatic, unforgiving anger. It isn't alive. Things do improve during the afternoon as I catch multiple sightings of deer and pass through a swamp-like woodland. Then, late on in the day, the impressive Corfe Castle comes into view. This ends a flat day on a high, and my spirits are enlivened as I stand and appraise the ancient structure. It's a sight, of course, that the coast path would not have shown me. I continue into the village of Corfe itself. I find a pub, order the obligatory local ale, and plonk myself in the beer garden with a decent view of the castle. I call Tasha and my folks, and in between my rants regarding the sheer selfishness of the armed forces, we discuss, for the first time, the arrangements for my pending return to stinky old reality. I'm vaguely conscious that I'm not really accepting the looming finish line as being a reality just yet. I spend the rest of the evening getting slightly more than tipsy in the beer garden, watching a variety of colourful birds flutter and chirp in the evening sunshine. As the sun sets, I slump off to find what will be the last campsite of the trip. I've decided to give the canvas one last outing against my better judgment. I'd like to be able to say, with something close to a straight face, that I did a mixture of camping, B&Bs, pubs and hotels along the trip. I walk, groggy-eyed, but at pace, through Corfe, as the sun rises the following morning, leaving the campsite dwellings in my wake ludicrously early, desperate to get back to the coast and put the previous day's flat inland diversion behind me. It wasn't the worst night's sleep I've had under the canvas, and despite, or possibly because of, a Mars bar breakfast. The breakfast of champions. There's a spring in the step as I march onwards. I follow the Purbeck Way for the first few miles before finally rejoining the path at St. Alden's Head. I'm greeted by breathtaking views in both directions, including painfully tantalising glimpses of the walk I've been denied a day prior. As I set off in the direction of Worth Matravers, the sky is a clear and cloudless blue, and the sun beats down on my rejuvenated bones. A few minutes later, I spy a buzzard circling above over the grassy cliff edge that separates me from the calm, shimmering blue ocean. After consulting Rowley, I'm advised that in actual fact many of the buzzard sightings I've had could well have been marsh harriers. The one bird I thought I did actually recognise. The familiar chorus of 1,000 invisible songbirds caress the sky and raises my spirits even further. I'm filled with the comforting sensation of being home. A feeling of relief at being back on the trail after only 24 hours away. This brings about a brief panic at the pending journey's end, but I quickly push these thoughts aside before they can take root. Somewhere before or around Durlston Head, I come across an archetypal SWCP climb, a steep, stepped descent from clifftop down to sea level, and the corresponding climb back up immediately afterwards. A broad smile fills my face. It's a sight that only a few months ago would have filled me with dread and brought about the obligatory backpack-lamenting whinge-fest. Here and now, however, it sends a wave of excitement and adrenaline through me. Bring it on! Before I begin the descent, I pass a young couple sat on a bench on the clifftop. In other circumstances, their sweaty red faces and ungainly panting would have led me to believe I'd crassly interrupted a moment of secret passion. They both smile at me and then grimace at the sight of my backpack. "It's as tough as it looks. Good luck with that pack." I smile back, possibly a touch smugly, but resist the temptation to set them straight and explain that this is child's play to a seasoned pro like myself, because that would make me sound like a bit of a twonk. I clamber down the uneven steps at pace and climb up the other side without pausing for breath. Upon reaching the top, I continue, exhilarated and drenched in sweat. I resist the temptation to turn and wave triumphantly at the couple on the bench, because that would make me look like a bit of a twonk. A little while later, I sling off my backpack and sit, looking out to sea, and up at the circling gulls as they glide and weave gracefully, surveying their domain. As I watch them, I'm surprised to feel a tear rolling down my cheek. Not a noisy, overblown sob, you understand, dear reader. If anything, probably quite heroic and manly tears. It suddenly feels as though this has been coming for days. This incredible adventure is all but at an end, and I suppose the reality of that is at last sinking in. I desperately miss Tasha, my family, and my friends, and will be over the moon to be with them again. But this has been an even more enriching and beautiful experience than I ever could have hoped for. I'll miss the nomadic freedom, the feeling of being on an endless journey. As previously said, life concentrated into its purest and most simple form. Walk, eat, walk, sleep, repeat. I drink in the horizon as though it's my last. The beautiful and silent sea glistens in the sunlight, and I am a tiny dot on the cliff edge. The dramatic, ever-changing yet eternal and constant coastline stretches off into infinity in either direction. Every beautiful square foot of this landscape that I've encountered in the last 8 weeks will continue to play out its daily drama centuries after I'm gone, as was the case for centuries past. My epic journey is no more than a passing moment. This living, breathing coastline will not miss me as I will miss it. I regain my composure and continue on my way, ending the day's walk with a gentle stroll down the promenade into Swanage and the last B&B of the trip. Swanage is also the last of the familiar South Coast seaside towns on this trip. As I wander down the promenade later that night past the amusement arcades and fish and chip shops in the evening sunshine, I come across a melee of people gathered around a woman with a microphone and a few cameramen. The BBC is filming for the local news programme. I phone my mum, who lives on the south coast, and tell her to switch on the TV. I then proceed to move on tiptoes through the crowd, waving my arms in the air like a demented idiot. It soon becomes apparent that the filming isn't live, and my mum has no idea what I'm blithering on about. The last day. I wake, ready for the last day in a numb daze of denial. A short 7-mile walk, including the final stretch across the sandy beach of Studland Bay to South Haven Point. I move slower than I have done in 2 months to prolong the final hours and wallow in the dying embers of my adventure. Reality awaits me, and I feel in no hurry to greet it. As I leave Swanage, heading for the impressive old Harry Rocks with their characteristic white cliffs, I'm deep in thought. I try to contemplate why this trip has meant so much to me, and why every bone in my body is now crying out at me to turn around and walk the whole path back to Minehead. A few months prior to the start of the walk, I was at a corporate conference event through work. I work in the finance industry, and on that day was sat in a room with 300 or so colleagues, all talking enthusiastically about the banking industry, its potential future, its current challenges, etc. A variety of speakers took to the stage throughout the day, pushing with genuine enthusiasm the current mantras of the organisation and discussing how we can all achieve great things for ourselves, our business and our customers. There was a moment during the afternoon, whilst pretending to listen and praying that nobody would ask me to venture an opinion on anything being said, that I suddenly asked myself a question. What decisions have I made in my life that have led me to be in this room with these people? Seriously, how has this happened? The company I work for has treated me very well, and many of the people I work with are amongst my dearest friends. I have no cause for complaint whatsoever and would not say a bad word against my employer. Yet the truth remains that of every known subject on this earth, you could search for a lifetime and not discover one that interests me less than economics and banking. Seriously, I'm more interested in crocheting. So how am I here? Have I really made a lifetime of bad choices? Every time I've met a fork in the road, have I really picked the wrong path? No. The truth is much, much worse. Every decision I've made in my life has been founded on apathy and fear. I have on every single occasion picked the path of least resistance, the easy route. So there I was, an overweight, unhealthy, stressed-out insomniac pushing 40, sat in a conference hall pretending to be someone I'm not, and with nobody to blame but myself. By this point, I had already discovered a passion for walking, and I'm certain it was because of this that I was now asking myself these questions. There was actually something in my life now that inspired me and pushed me. Something I wanted. And it had given me perspective. These are the reasons that this trip has meant so much to me. Because I made it happen. I achieved it. It wasn't the easy route, either literally or figuratively. It's been a physical and mental challenge, but it's also something that most of my peers simply don't understand. As I think about all of this, 4 major conflicting emotions rage within me. Immense pride at having walked 630 miles on my own. A sense of foreboding at returning to the real world and having to summon the strength to then make the changes I need to in my everyday life. Overwhelming joy at being with my loved ones again, and a total and profound sadness that this incredible experience is ending. I subconsciously begin muttering a mantra under my breath. This is who I am. This is what I am. This is why I am, my reason, and where I belong. I will not go quietly. Passers-by, of whom there are many along this popular and accessible final section, become increasingly alarmed at the leather-skinned, muddy ne'er-do-well with the oversized backpack audibly chanting and staring out to sea. They move their children and dogs away from me to safety. By the time I reach the Pinnacles and Harry, I'm still whispering it. This is who I am. This is what I am. This is why I am. My reason and where I belong. I will not go. go quietly. I stand for 40 minutes on the iconic chalky cliff edge, gazing out at the horizon. Attempting to summon up a mental montage of my trip, I want an emotional, slow-motion run-through of my experiences in sepia tone, with Carter USM's version of The Impossible Dream playing in the background. But I cannot do it. Something in my brain has protectively shut itself down, and I can only see the sea. My sea. Gently swaying off into infinity. Even the manly tears of the previous day will not appear. I'm in shutdown, as if my brain has crossed the finish line before my feet. I begrudgingly trudge on towards the beach. As I reach it, I come across a cafe and sit consuming a strawberry milkshake. The place is packed to the rafters with screaming children and stressed parents out for a day at the beach on a sunny Saturday. Real life is bleeding into my trip, and I don't feel ready for it yet. A mile further down the beach, I take off my backpack and sit on the sand, in the quietest spot I can find. As I unsheathe the final Mars bar of the trip, a naked, elderly, overweight gentleman appears, striding purposefully from the sand dunes behind me, and stops a few feet in front of me, facing out to sea. He stands, legs apart and hands on hips, the image of his fluorescent white saggy buttocks burning itself into my retina. Suddenly, I'm not hungry, and I place the Mars bar back into my bag, where it will remain ceremoniously uneaten. I've inadvertently wandered into the naturist section of the beach. Over the next half hour or so, I come to understand that the naturist community, of this beach at least, is very nearly exclusively made up of aged, overweight men. I'm full of admiration for their bravado. "That's right, sonny boy. I'm naked. What of it?" I wonder what they do during the week. Are they accountants, tree surgeons and cashiers? Do they represent a broad cross-section of society? Or are there professions that are top-heavy with naturists? These questions and many more remain unanswered. Eventually, I stroll on, walking out to where the waves gently lap at the shoreline and wash over my tired and cracked boots. In this final mile, I meet the last person of the trip, a girl in jean shorts and a straw hat, walking in the opposite direction, sporting a correctly sized backpack and wearing an excited smile on her face. "Hello," she beams. "Have you been walking the coast path?" We exchange pleasantries, and it transpires she is just starting out and is also going to attempt the full 630 miles. "I'm envious of you. You've got an amazing 2 months ahead of you," I say.
2 months?
"Oh, no, I'll be doing it in 5 weeks at the most."
"Sure, 5 weeks. That's what I meant to say."
As I reach the end of the beach and the last ferry crossing of the journey, the finishing line sculpture comes into view. A blue steel affair stood next to a wooden waymarker, advising that Minehead is 630 miles in the other direction. I again briefly consider walking all the way back, before taking a clumsy selfie that cuts off the top of my head. Luckily, at that moment, a fully clothed man walks past and volunteers to take my picture for me. As I stand reviewing the photograph in the hot May sunshine, I reflect on how different the face staring back at me is to the one in the corresponding picture taken in Minehead 8 weeks prior. I'm at least a stone and a half lighter, and feel fitter than I have done in 2 decades. I've also slept at least 7 hours a night for the majority of the last 8 weeks, and feel sharper and stronger as a result. I do, however, have a grey streak in my hair that wasn't there previously, and, as we've discussed, dear reader, my skin looks like it's made of old leather. The baby-faced, pasty, wheezing couch potato has been replaced by a thin, weathered old man. Swings and roundabouts, I suppose. As I cross the water for the final time, my spirits are brightened at the prospect of the welcoming committee that awaits me on the other side. Tasha, my mum, and my stepdad Dennis have driven to meet me, and I'm suddenly overcome with excitement at the thought of seeing them. I have 700 photographs to show them and 1,000 stories to tell, the lucky devils. Upon meeting my reception party, congratulations and a few final photographs ensue. My mum,
delighted to find me alive and well, and not butchered at the hands of a crazed old Cornish fisherman, comments instead on my resemblance to an aforementioned crazed old Cornish fisherman. We drive back to Mum and Dennis's house, where we meet my brother Mark and his partner Tom for dinner. I spend the next few hours regaling them all with stories from the trip, my favourite spots, the most difficult stretches, and the folk I met along the way. That spectacular, inspiring, dramatic and life-affirming coastline stretching out into infinity. I thank my mum for resisting the temptation to spend her and Dennis's life savings on a boat so that she could follow me around for the last 2 months, ensuring I don't fall off a cliff or run out of clean pants. As we all feast, I watch Tasha laughing with my brother and look at my wonderful mum making a fuss of everyone. I beam with complete joy as I bask in the glow and warmth of their company. I have done it. 8 weeks, 630 miles, 26,719 steps, 921 styles, 302 bridges, 91,000 feet of climbing and descending, 1 family of seals, 0 basking sharks, 1 slush puppy, 4 rollies, and 1 overweight, oversized backpack. Not bad for a pasty podge face pushing 40. Epilogue. Every now and then, when I'm driving, working, eating a potato, or lying awake thinking about death, or maybe even hiking somewhere inland across a moor or through woodlands, the sea calls to me. No matter what time it is or how far away from it I am, I go to it. Travelling 40, 50, 100 miles out of my way to be with it. To walk the path at Sidmouth in the driving rain, or Coombe Martin in a dense winter fog. I suspect that the most likely reason for this is that I unintentionally left a layer of my consciousness on the coast path when I returned to normal life. Abandoned to forever walk the trail back and forth between Minehead and Poole Harbour. From time to time, whatever signal it's emitting hits the right frequency at the right moment to find me. Then, when I reach the sea, the splintered layer of consciousness temporarily reattaches itself to me, and as the smell, sound and feel of the sea penetrate my senses, I am whole again. An almost unbearable wave of happiness washes through me. Oddly, every time this happens, I realise that in the time that has elapsed since I was last with the sea, I have forgotten that I'm not whole, and that this level of happiness is possible. Life has filled my head with electricity bills, pasta bakes, Netflix, stress, spreadsheets, referendums, and decay. The sea tells me again that all this is a fiction, a meaningless and elaborate construction. It shows me that life is simple, clear and endlessly beautiful. I thank the sea and walk beside it for a time. Just as my spirit begins to dance and my heart is about to burst with purest joy, the splintered layer of consciousness leaves me again so that I can begin the journey back to the other reality. By the time I arrive, my thoughts have turned to food shopping, team meetings, mini breaks, and overdrafts. I cannot hear the sea now, but I belong to it, and it will find me. You've been listening to Just Off for a Walk by Stephen Reynolds, narrated by Jeff Cummings, published by Whole Story Quest, an imprint of W.F. Howes Limited. This work is copyrighted 2017, Stephen Reynolds. This recording is copyrighted 2018, W.F. Howes Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.